I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude, drawing this time on the novelist Robert Coover's exercise of conscience about freedom of expression in the world today. Burma was the focus this week of what's become an annual International Writers Project teach-in at Brown. Burma of the thin-skinned but immovable military regime in Rangoon. Burma of the Nobel Prize prisoner and nonviolent point of resistance Aung San Suu Kyi. Burma of Kipling's old Road to Mandalay and the mahogany, jewels, and oil that the British Empire stripped from the land between the 1880s and World War II. After our week with Burmese poets, artists, and writers who've done hard times, some in solitary, in modern Burma, our conversation here is with Robert Coover about the artist's predicament, and with the Indian writer Amitav Ghosh, whose first big novel, The Glass Palace, retold the colonial story behind Burma today. Resonating all around this conversation somewhere is the spreading news of official U.S. torture of terror suspects after the 9/11 attack on New York through the war in Iraq. Robert Coover, this is an annual observance of freedom of expression at Brown, an institution by now, the focus on Burma this year, where poets and writers languish in solitary confinement under a military regime. Put Burma and what you've experienced this week in the context of all the work you've done and the whole suffering world these days.
Well, it's an extreme example, and I'd say that when we look at our applicants each year and consider the possible choices that we have, Burma would be very near the top of the list of where we'd say the conditions are right. We're looking for very significant writers. We want them to have an ability to participate in a community. We have other qualifications, but and their own personal circumstances, but one of the criteria is the situation in the country from which they come. And Burma ranks very much up with the other, like it has been today, this week compared, for example, to North Korea or to Zimbabwe, et cetera. Mm. It's not as dysfunctional as some countries like Darfur or Zimbabwe. It has a powerful central force that is holding things together by force alone, but it's doing that by restrictions, well, of all kinds of human rights questions, not merely freedom of expression. But freedom of expression touches them more deeply there than I have seen in most countries. I mean, it seems that writers have more of are more a thorn in the side of the powers that be than one would find in other hostile countries. Sometimes writers can just kind of get by doing stuff on the side and not be paid much attention to. But writers in Burma are really taken seriously by the regime.
Amitav Ghosh, you know more about Burma than all of us. And as always, in your book, The Glass Palace, you break through that amnesia curtain into the colonial past. It reminds me of Mahmoud Mamdani talking the other day with us about Sudan and Darfur. We're just beginning to deal with colonial history. Give us a taste of Burma's past that you wrote about in The Glass Palace.
Well, you know, Burma, of course, had this... Burma experienced colonialism perhaps in the most extreme way, where really it was just completely ransacked. I mean, after 1885, in many ways it was actually strangely similar to Iraq. The British went in 1885 under the sort of guise of freedom and so on.
Shock and awe.
Shock and awe, tyranny, all those tropes were there. But then after that, they were faced with this very long resistance. So over this 10-year pacification campaign, thousands and thousands of Burmese were killed. And ever after, you know, the countryside was always sort of fairly unsettled, so there was a lot of brigandage and so on. And, so then after that, I think what has really sort of also profoundly affected Burma is the Second World War. People don't sort of adequately recognize that, you know, in the Second World War, when the British were withdrawing from Burma, against the Japanese attack, they adopted this scorched earth policy. So they literally laid waste to all the infrastructure they themselves had built in Burma. You know, all the bridges, all the railways, all the warehouses, all the oil pumps. I mean, oil derricks. I mean, everything was just blown up. And then but the Japanese did come in. And then when the British were reinvading, the Japanese adopted the same policy. You know, so Burma was flattened twice, completely flattened. And, you know, you think of, say, the sort of aid that Europe got, the Marshall Plan and so on, after the Second World War. Burma got nothing, you know. There it was, this really poor country, completely devastated. And, you know, it had nothing. It had no way of rebuilding itself. So, you know, what has happened in Burma is really one of the great tragedies for which really the whole world is, in a sense, bears some responsibility.
You write about the removal of the king and queen of Burma to a village in India, to a slum in India, as the great stroke of destroying hundreds of years of relationships that had been mediated by the monarchy. How does a country get back from that, or does it?
I think, you know, all those issues have basically been deferred in Burma, you know. I mean, because the military regime is so kind of repressive and so extreme that it's just tried to hold it together completely by force. I think the future that, to me, would seem to be the most appealing future for Burma is really when ASEAN, as a sort of Southeast Asian grouping, becomes so strong. I mean, becomes maybe like the EU, where really the, you know, single countries no longer make that much difference.
Could I ask, there are two very different threads in the conversation today, and I'd love you to recapitulate them. One, in the back of my mind, through all the descriptions of suffering in Burma, one can't hear these things this week in the United States without the backdrop of what we're learning about torture. What is it called? Harsh questioning tactics. Nobody wants to use the big T word. How do we assimilate this knowledge of what we revile abroad and what we're learning about ourselves right here and now?
You know, I must say, in many ways, since, I mean, I sort of knew that the Iraq War was going to be a catastrophe, and, you know, we talked about this at the time. But
we did.
Since then, I mean, so much that happened there actually is incomprehensible. You know, leave aside the torture. Do you remember in the first weeks after the fall of Baghdad, there was a Iraqi general who actually went to the American authorities and surrendered. You know, he surrendered to his authorities. His sons came with him. Thereafter, the next he was heard of, he'd been wrapped in a carpet and beaten so badly that he died. Now, can you imagine, say, an American doing that to, say, a German general in the Second World War? It's inconceivable. I mean, can you imagine, say, the British doing that to a French general, you know, during the Napoleonic Wars? It's literally inconceivable. And it makes you think, how is it possible that these deep, deep taboos, not just within global culture, but specifically within Western culture, come to be flouted so easily? You know, do you understand what I mean? I mean, it's kind of incomprehensible. How did they do this? This other thing, this torture business, you know, the Prussian state of old abolished torture as a you know, as a method in the 18th century, because you know, Frederick the Great said it doesn't work. All the things that people are saying today, he said, and ever since it's been one of the rules of warfare. You know, and you know, the rules of warfare were basically what decided what civilized conduct was. You know, that this is not something that actually pays dividends necessarily. So strange to see these arguments being rehashed like over 200 years later.
Yes, I think our one of our huge problems is that all of that is just ancient prehistory. Anything before World War II, and even that's getting to be prehistory, is just not part of the consciousness of the people who are our alleged leaders. I mean, there's very little literacy, genuine literacy, amongst the, let's say, the CIA operatives, the rank and file, and the officers too of the military. There's nothing. They are not taught any of this as history. So their history is military history, and their notion is simply it's a kind of a blunt tactic, and often involves just understanding their weaponry. It isn't really there's no you spoke some about the source of moral behavior or consciousness, and this is not a topic in a military class. You would never hear about this, and the people who are signed into most police operations, to FBI, CIA, whatever, have never been actually schooled in this. This is not a literate country in that way. We're quite a provincial nation, and our education does not really reach very deep. And I think that's part of that. These guys getting this power moment. Well, what do you do? All they've got is a kind of guide, maybe as a fraternity and an initiation or something. They don't know really what to do with it.
But Robin,
and it turns out in the end that the techniques we were using, in fact, came to us from the Chinese.
Yes. You know, the CIA and the FBI, their agents were not keen to carry through this policy. It's clear now that it's guys who are very highly educated, like this John Yoo and so on, who went to Yale and who, I'm sure, had an excellent education.
Throw in the Harvard Law School, please.
Yes, all of that. I mean, they were the people who were behind these policies, not the grunt out there.
The other thread I'd love you to explain, Amitav, was exactly the opposite notion. Contra the impulse to politicize everything, you were speaking of the woman under house arrest in Rangoon whose ultimate caution to her friends is don't let politics consume you. I thought it was a fascinating idea to rescue the inner life and even for us to be aware of inner lives elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm not arguing at all for a political quietism or anything like that, because I do think that it's very important to be engaged with the world around you and so on. But I do think it's also very important to recognize that, you know, that there is a distinction. I mean, that, you know, politics is not all of life, and it can't subsume all of life. Beneath that, there is also, say, to take some ordinary examples, just friendship and love and so many other things. I mean, you know, you cannot cannibalize all of life for the sake of politics.
You spoke of it as a kind of postmodern fallacy and something that's very, very much alive on campuses like this one at Brown. Explain.
Well, you know, in a sense, when I grew up, the India that I was growing up in, the campus life that I was growing up in, was intensely politicized, you know. I mean, you were either this or that, and it seeped into all your judgments of everything. And, you know, in some strange way, America today is more like the India of the past, I have to say. I see that same thing sort of seeping into many aspects of American life, where really it's become so hyper-politicized. All judgments have become so hyper-politicized that people often can't make rational judgments. I mean, like on Darfur, you know, as you see from Mahmoud's book, how many bad judgments have gone into formulating the whole discourse around Darfur? It's simply because people are not able to pay attention.
And they're also not able to think of morality outside these questions of American foreign policy.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I mean, certainly, you know, I think at this particular moment in time, for Americans do bear a great burden, you know, which is that of their power to cause harm in the world is so great, and harm or good. So there is this great burden, and it does weigh heavily upon people, and so it should. But it should not become, you know, it should not become the entirety of life, because that's when you lose. It's when you lose all those commonsensical things which tell you. I mean, that is why, you know, it's by using these moralistic arguments that, for example, that a certain kind of liberal imperialist was able to support this Iraq war and he was able to spook many aspects of the left into supporting this Iraq war, because they were just able to make them lose their common sense.
So how then do we rescue our own inner lives, particularly from this notion of politics as the ultimate repository of moral questions?
I don't know. I don't know if Robert would even agree with this view.
Well, I do. And on the other hand, I've also worked a lot on political issues and have always been disappointed at how few often were alert to those issues and how many were sunning themselves on the green, enjoying their inner lives. I think that one of the roots, and it's what we all pretend anyway, is the root, is that art itself has this function. So yes. The novel, the painting, and of course even digital art now, whatever it is, music, all are modes of coming to a deep focus without having an external object to which that is aimed, so that you can be moved by music even at the same time you're moved against American foreign policy, let's say.
That's right.
And I think that's our hope as
yes, absolutely.
Performers.
I think that's very well put.
Amitav Ghosh, Robert Coover, thank you enormously on this Freedom of Expression Thursday at Brown in April 2009. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Philip Gara produced and Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Robert Coover and Amitav Ghosh at the International Writers Project session on Burma at Brown University. Pitch in your own two bits on history, morality, politics, torture, and free expression at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.